Our study tonight is Nahum chapter 3. Interesting chapter, as it turns out. We've already made the point so far in this book that it's actually divided into three sections. Chapter 1 is the destruction of Nineveh decreed. Chapter 2 is the destruction of Nineveh described. And our chapter tonight is the destruction of Nineveh. It's deserved, is the basic message. What we've not been told so far is why does Nineveh deserve to be destroyed? That's not been explained so far in the book. Now, we've talked about it in previous studies, but in the actual text itself, in the actual book of Nahum, we've not been explicitly told why the city of Nineveh deserves to be destroyed. So that's what our study tonight is all about. Our study tonight, I'd like to say, is like wading into an acre of mud. It's like wading through mud. I think most of us would not want to be crawling through a bunch of mud. It's dirty, it's not very pleasant, but the reason I say that our study tonight is like wading through a bunch of mud is because it's about a nation that has committed sin upon sin. And we're going to be seeing some of that description tonight. It is the sin of the nation. And the entire book of Nahum is a description of the coming judgment. It's different from all of the other minor prophets. This is a very unique minor prophet because it targets a city. It talks about a city. Obadiah talked about a nation called Edom. This book, Nahum, talks about a city and the evil in that city and the coming judgment on that city. Chapter 1 is about the judgment on the city. Chapter 2 is about judgment on the city. And chapter 3 is about judgment on the city. Chapter 3 also happens to describe why they deserve to be judged. And so it's just really an incredible book from the standpoint of what it does. It's really unique in the pages of the Old Testament because it is all about the destruction of this city. And it is described in all three chapters. Just an incredible book. And you have to ask yourself a question, which we're going to deal with at the end, is why are all three chapters about the destruction of the city? I mean, why talk about the destruction in three chapters? Why can't you do it in one chapter or a couple of verses? But why devote an entire book to the destruction of a city? It would seem like it's over the top. And we're going to get a description tonight as to why the city deserves to be judged, and the description is very brief. And even most of the chapter is about the destruction of the city. Just a very different minor prophet. In Nahum chapter 1, verse 8, we already saw is that the destruction was announced when we were in chapter 1. When we were in chapter 2, we saw that the destruction of Nineveh was further described. It started in chapter 1, it continued in 2. And in chapter 3, as I've already pointed out, we're going to continue seeing the destruction, but we're going to see why the city deserves to be judged. So chapter 3, as you're going to see in a few minutes, can be broken up into three sections. Verses 1 through 3 is the first charge of guilt. Verses 4 through 7 is the second charge of guilt. And verses 8 through 19 is the third charge of guilt. And we're going to obviously take those in that order. So we'll be dealing with the first charge or the first reason why they are guilty and deserve to be destroyed. That's the first point. So let's get into verse 1. And verse 1 is going to describe their sins, and this is basically the reason that they deserve to be destroyed. Verse 1 says, "Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage, her prey never departs." Very short verse, but it lays out the charges. The first thing is that it's a bloody city. That implies that it's full of murder. It's been murdering people. Now remember that Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And this is where the kings of the Assyrian Empire would sit. And so this is the headquarters. And so when it says, woe to the bloody city, the message is that this was a city that controlled what the empire did, and it destroyed and killed, and so it's a bloody city. So the first charge is that it has committed murder. Then it says, completely full of lies and pillage. The phrase, completely full of lies, the actual Hebrew is shorter. It says this, the literal Hebrew is, all of it a lie. All of it a lie. In other words, everything is a lie. Everything is a lie. Everything that Nineveh did was a lie. So they murdered, and everything they did was a lie. Historical records tell us, now here's a very important point since we're dealing with prophecy. In other words, verse 1 is talking about what they did. What historical records tell us is that they made alliances and truces with different nations and different groups, and they never kept one of the alliances. They broke every one of them. I mean, what a dishonest group, and they did it for their own benefit. When it says the prey never departs, it meant that they never ran out of prey. The New American Standard says, prey never departs. The ESV changes the wording and correctly changes the wording. It's actually the idea that they had plenty of prey and they get done with one and they went to another and they went to another. There was always prey to go after, and blood and lies is the trail that they left. What an incredible nation. They were self-centered. They were greedy. And so the charge is that the empire was guilty of murder, guilty of lies, and guilty of being greedy, and they exploited every nation that they could. Now, verse 2 is a little different. Verse 2 now goes back to the final assault, and you're going to see it's a description of the chariots that are racing. Verse 1 was a description of their sins. Verse 2 is back to the battle. So, verse 1 is like a little sidestep, almost like a little commercial explaining what's going on. And verse 2 now is back to the what you were seeing on your television. And it says, the noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses and abounding chariots. What's described as chariots. The riders in the chariots. We made the point last time that the chariots actually were Scythide chariots. That meant that off of the hub of the wheel there was a knife that actually came out, or a blade that came out. And so as the chariots are racing down the street, if somebody decided to get near the chariot to try to attack the chariot or do something to the person on the chariot, they had to contend with this blade that was sticking out of the hub of the chariots as it's going down the street, and very dangerous chariots. And so the idea here is that when it says the noise of the whip, that is that the man who is in the chariot, he is whipping the horses. And they can hear the noise, the crack of the whip on the horse, and the noise of the rattling of the wheels. So the wheels are rattling as they're going down the street, and the horses are racing, and so the chariots are flying down the street. This is the invading army. Verse 3 is the horsemen are charging. So you have riders now on horses, and they're charging. And it says, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, a mass of corpses, the countless dead bodies, they stumble over the dead bodies. Just a massive slaughter is being described. So you have the chariots going down the street, you have the horsemen going down, they have swords, they're cutting people, spears are stabbing people, and many slain, mass corpses, dead bodies everywhere, people are stumbling over the bodies. It's war. Massive slaughter is being described as the Babylonian and the Median Empire, those are the primary two empires that joined forces against the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire, we pointed out last time, is like the Goliath. And so a bunch of little empires came together to defeat the Goliath. And what we're getting here is the description of the battle that was going on. When you come to verse 4 now, what you end up with is you are into the second charge. The second charge of guilt, and verse 4 again is the description of sins. Each of these sections starts off with the description of the sins, and then you resume the battle, essentially, for the most part. But in this particular case, you're going to get a description of the sins and then God's plan. God's going to tell us now what his plan is against the Assyrian Empire. But let's look at the Syrians' sins first in verse 4. This is the second charge of guilt. This is not about murder. This is not about lies. And this is not about greed. Here we're told, and all because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charging one, the mistress of sorceries who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. Very interesting verse. The root word for harlotries occurs three times in this verse. First time is harlotries and then harlot. And near the end of the verse, it talks about harlotries again. Three times this root Hebrew word shows up. The word is translated on other occasions as having the idea of uncontrolled lust. And typically, we tend to think of sexual. It could be that, but it could also be a lot of other things. It could be uncontrolled whatever. Maybe you have a hobby and it just is life-consuming, that you give yourself to it. The idea is that something that drives your passion and it's uncontrolled, you just give in to it. It could also refer to prostitution. It can also refer to pollution. It can also refer to unfaithfulness. And it's probably safe to assume that all of these are in play in verse 4. That is, that the city of Nineveh was guilty of all of these. It's just a city, an empire, just given to sin. Because it says, because of the many harlotries of the harlot. It's like being in the harlot. This is basically the idea. It turns out when it says the charming one, I believe, and other commentators believe, that what's actually being described here is that they're very politically influential. And the reason that they're politically influential is because of they're into the occult. Notice what it says. The charming one, the mistress of sorceries. They're being influenced by the occult. How many nations of the world, would you say, are influenced by demons? I believe the answer is every one. Every one of them is influenced by demons. You might say, like, why do you say that? Well, turn to Daniel 10 for a minute. In the morning, we actually visited this a couple of weeks ago, but we did not do that in the evening. So in sense it applies, we're going to visit it tonight. In Daniel chapter 10, verse 10, I'm going to start reading so you see that there is demonic influence in every nation. In fact, I believe that there are demons who are greatly influencing the United States and being very successful. Verse 10 says, "Then behold, a hand touched me," Daniel's talking. And he says, "and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you. And stand upright, for I have now been sent to you." And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. I just like it when I read that Daniel is a man of high esteem. In chapter 9, Daniel is actually referred to as being a precious man. Would you like to be a precious man if you're a man? Wouldn't you like God to describe you as being precious? That's what Daniel's described as. You usually think of that as being for a woman. If it comes from God, I'll take it. I mean, I'd love to be a precious man in God's sight. Verse 12, "And then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this," understanding what? Well, Daniel made a prayer request. Daniel wanted some information. And we're told that he humbled himself before God. "Your words were heard, and I've come in response to your words." Now that's verse 12. Now when you come to verse 13, you'll find out that Daniel did not get an instant answer to his prayer. It says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. And then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia." So what are we told in verse 13? This angel that had been dispatched to come to Daniel to answer his prayer request had been delayed for 21 days because he was being opposed by some demons referred to here as the kings of Persia. If you jump to verse 20, we're going to skip a bunch of the discussion between the angel and Daniel. But if you go to verse 20, it says, "And then he said, do you understand why I came to you?" So the angel is speaking, "But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come." The message is, it's not just the prince of Persia I'm going to have to deal with. I also have the prince of Greece, verse 21. "However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is one who stands firmly with me against these forces, except Michael, your prince." So the point here is that there's a war in the invisible world among holy angels and demons or evil angels. We have no idea what it means that they're fighting. I don't think they have tanks and bazookas and handguns and swords and knives. There's some kind of battle that they have. How they win, I don't know. How they win, you don't know. None of us actually has any clue how or what goes on. All we know is that there's a tug of war in the angelic world. Now, what these passages do reveal, though, is that there are demons over every nation and every empire around the globe. So the United States has some demons who are very influential. All you have to do is look at the direction of our country, where it's going. They're being very successful. If you were to go to Ezekiel chapter 28, you find out another very interesting influence on nations, and it comes from Satan himself, or the devil himself. This is the very important passage of Scripture talking about the king of Tyre. We're going to find out that Satan is actually the force behind the king of Tyre. Satan is actually the influential power behind the king of Tyre. Chapter 28 of Ezekiel, verse 2 says, "Son of man, say to the leader of Tyre, thus says the Lord God, because your heart is lifted up, and you said, I'm a god, and I sit in the seat of gods in the heart of the seas." And it goes on. So it's talking about Tyre, but now if you jump to verse 12, notice what happens. It says, "Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you have the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God." Now, question, when did the Garden of Eden exist? At the time Ezekiel wrote? Answer is no. It existed long before that, at the beginning of time, almost. Okay, but shortly after the world was created, according to Genesis chapter 2. This occurred thousands of years later. So if the king of Tyre is being described as one who is in the Garden of Eden, there's a problem, right? Keep reading. "Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, onyx, jasper, lapis lazuli, the turquoise, emerald, the gold, and the gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you on the day that you were created. They were prepared." Now, I have another question for you. What human being has all this stuff as part of his body? What human can be described as having rubies and topaz and diamonds as part of his physical body? Do you see a second problem? Watch the third problem, verse 14. "And you are the anointed cherub who covers." Covers what? The ark. Covers God, actually, in this case. "And I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God." Now, the king of Tyre can't be an angel. The anointed cherub. Who was the anointed cherub who was in the Garden of Eden? Satan, the devil. What's being described here is that Satan, or the devil, is the power behind the king. Guess what's being described back here in Nahum now? Nahum chapter 3, verse 4 says, "The charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries." What's being described is that there's demonic influence behind the Assyrian Empire, the throne room, which is seated in the city of Nineveh. And by occultic influence, by demonic influence, They were very effective politically in making truces and alliances with kings and nations for their own benefit. And then they turned around and they sold nations and families. So there was no commitment. How atrocious is this? So they're guilty of murder, they're guilty of lies, they're guilty of greed, and they're guilty of demonic influence and taking advantage of other nations. Verse 5. So God says, behold, I'm against you, declares the Lord. God says, I'm going to lift up your skirts over your face and show to the nations your nakedness and to the kingdoms your disgrace. So God's saying, here's my plan. God's saying, here's what's going to happen to you. I'm going to shame you. That's what's being described in verse 5. In verse 6, God's going to make them a spectacle. In verse 7, he's going to devastate them. So this is all against Nineveh, and God's going to do it. So verse 5 says, I'm going to shame you. It's a rather interesting description. God says, I'm going to lift up your skirts, as though the empire actually had skirts. So it's obviously a figurative statement. And going to show your nakedness. And so obviously if it's an empire, it obviously doesn't have any nakedness. But what God's really saying is, I'm going to shame you. And it's important to notice at the very end of the verse, it says, unto the nations your disgrace. And that's the idea. God's going to shame them. This also tells us something about nakedness. It's shameful to be naked, except obviously with your spouse. That's a different situation. But otherwise, to be displaying yourself, to be showing yourself, showing your nakedness to other people, it should be shameful to you. Look at Revelation chapter 16, verse 15. Don't lose your place, we're coming back. Well, Revelation 16, 15. This makes it even clearer that being naked should be shameful to us. Yet we have Hollywood stars and we have noted individuals taking their clothes off, and supposedly it's liberating, and supposedly it's the good thing to do, and they get fame for it. They enhance their career by doing it. Verse 15 says, behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his clothes, so that he will not walk about naked, and men will not see his, what does it say? Shame. I mean, this is a very clear verse that walking around naked and letting other people see you is a shameful thing. So the idea that somehow it's supposed to be liberating, it's really a good thing, is not true biblically. And so people who do it, that tells us that there's something wrong in their moral compass. There's something wrong with them morally, that they're willing to reveal their nakedness. Now, as you know, that Genesis chapter 2, we're told that the man and wife, they were naked, and they were what? Not ashamed. So between husband and wife, that's a whole different situation. But otherwise, it should be shameful to a person who is sensitive to the things of the Lord. Verse 6. Verse 6 now is God's going to make them a spectacle. I will throw filth on you and make you vile and set you up as a spectacle. The actual word for filth is feces. It's really descriptive. And it's very difficult to know exactly what God is trying to say, other than he's going to make them a spectacle, because that's what he says at the end of the verse. So in some way, God's going to shame them. In some way, God's going to make them a spectacle, and then God's going to devastate them. And it all is connected to this destruction, this battle. Verse 7, and it will come about that all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated, and you will grieve for her. Where will I seek comforters for you? And when it says, and where will I seek comforters for you, the idea is that there's not going to be anybody who's going to come to comfort you. Verse 8 now is another section. This is the third charge of guilt, and it actually goes through verse 10. So there's three verses in this charge of guilt, and it's all about the sins of being proud. When it says in verse 8, and are you better than Naaman, which was situated by the waters of the Nile, with waters surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea and whose wall consisted of the sea? What's being described in this case is really the city of Thebes. Noamon is another name for the city of Thebes. Now, if you're not sure what the city of Thebes was, the city of Thebes was a city in Egypt. It was along the Nile, and there were some major temples right near that. One of them was Luxor. Another one was Karna. That's the names of the modern sites, but Thebes was in Egypt. And it turns out that Thebes was the capital of the pharaohs. Charles Feinberg says this, it was the greatest city of the Near East. The greatest city of the Near East. And so when it says in verse 8, are you better than, I'm going to change the wording, Thebes? Are you better than Thebes? Are you better than the greatest city of the Near East? Apparently they thought they were. And so what the verse is saying, you're not. You think you are, but you're not. Now I want to just give you a couple more pieces of information about the city. The city was located on the Nile River. And if you're wondering, how do we know it's the greatest city of the Near East? Guess what? Its ruins covered 27 miles. That's a mammoth city. The ruins covered 27 miles. And it turns out that Ammon was the chief god of the Egyptians. And check out Jeremiah chapter 46, verse 25. That's chapter 46, verse 25. Check out Ezekiel chapter 30, verses 14 to 16. And there you're going to see prophecies about the defeat and destruction in 1663 BC of Thebes. And then God said that there would be no city greater than Thebes. And apparently Nineveh thought they were greater. Now you might say, why did they think they were greater? Well, a couple of things. And it's going to come up in verse 10. But first of all, in verse 9, I want to just make another couple of points. When it says, Ethiopia was her might, and Egypt too, without limits. Put and Lubim were among her helpers. What that's all referring to is that Ethiopia had an alliance with Thebes. When it says the people or Egypt too without limits, that is that all of the people of Egypt were very supportive of Thebes. Put was another nation that Thebes had an alliance with. And Lubin is modern-day Libya. So those were the alliances that Thebes had. Watch this. Thebes had great alliances, great support. Nineveh didn't. If you remember verse 7 at the very end, it says, where will I seek comforters for you? The idea is that there isn't anybody. And who will grieve for you? And the idea is that nobody's going to grieve for you. You have no alliances. You're all by yourself, is the point. So in verse 8, God describes, are you better than Thebes? And the answer is no. And verse 9 makes it a point that there are going to be people who will come to Thebes' rescue, but not for you. And verse 10, it says, and yet she became an exile, and she went into captivity, talking about Thebes. And also her small children were dashed to pieces, and at the head of every street, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound with fetters, that is, chains. Now you might say, well, what's being described? Well, what's being described in verse 10 is the Assyrian Empire, history tells us, came down and conquered Thebes. And the Assyrians wrote in their records, now watch this, the Assyrians wrote in their records that they slaughtered the children because they didn't want to have to be bothered with taking them back to the Assyrian Empire. They just slaughtered all of the children in the streets. And not just in the streets, they did it in the intersection of the streets so everybody could see what they were doing. Now, that's really wicked. And what did they do with the honorable men? They sold them like slaves, is what they did. Chained them and sold them. So Nineveh thought they were better than Thebes because they conquered them. What's God's point? No, you're not. That's not true. And look at the horrible thing that you did. I mean, that's the message. When you get to verse 11 now, verse 11 through 19 is the rest of the charge. So we've just seen the sins. Now what happens in verse 11? We return to the battle. So we get the battle again, and the battle's going to go fairly quick. Verse 11 says, the army gets drunk. You too will become drunk, and you'll be hidden, and you too will search for a refuge from the enemy. In other words, what we know from history, when what God is prophesying is going to happen, is that the army will be drunk, and they're going to run for protection. And that's exactly what happened. Historical records tell us that the Babylonian Median army, when they came in, they saw that the Assyrian army was drunk, and they scattered for protection. Verse 12, and all your fortifications are fig trees like ripe fruit, and when shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. Have you ever taken a fruit tree and wanted to get some fruit off of it, and you just started shaking the tree, and what happens if the fruit's ripe? It falls off. If it's not ripe, it just hangs on because it's not ripe yet. It's not ready to fall. So what's being described here is that your fortifications are like fig trees. All you got to do is shake it. It comes down. That's the idea. Shaken and they'll fall into the eater's mouth. In other words, the fortifications, they're really weak. That's the point. Verse 13, behold, your people are women in your midst. What do you think that means? What it means is that the people are weak. So the fortifications are weak. Actually, the soldiers are weak in verse 11 because they're drunk. They're ineffective. So the soldiers are ineffective in verse 12. The fortifications are ineffective. Verse 13, the rest of the people are weak. They're like women. And the gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies. We saw in our previous study that there was a flood that came and destroyed the floodgates. Fire consumes your gate bars. So what's left of the gates? There's fire that consumes the bars. So forget the floodgates. Now they're completely and totally defenseless. Verse 14, God's prophesying all these things are going to happen. And they all happened. Verse 14, draw for yourself water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Go into the clay and tread the mortar and take hold of the brick mold. Now what's being described in verse 14 is sarcasm. In fact, verse 15 is sarcasm. And what it's really saying is that, oh, go draw some water, because what do you need in a battle? You need food and you need water. So the idea is go get yourself some water because you're going to need it for the siege. Oh, and by the way, and strengthen your fortifications. Well, we just already saw in verse 12 that they're weak and they've already been shaken and fallen down. And then when it says, go out into the clay and tread it and make brick molds, what they used to do back in those days is that they would make extra bricks. So when the attacking army would attack your wall and break down part of the wall, the idea was you were to go back then and you put these bricks back in place, getting ready for the next attack in order to protect yourself. So the idea is run, go make all these preparations while the chariots are racing down the street and the horsemen are racing down the street, killing everybody. It's sarcasm. You're defeated. Oh, but go hurry, try to protect yourself. And the idea is it's pointless. Verse 15, and there fire will consume you, the sword will cut you down, and it will consume you as the locust does. And then here's the next sarcasm. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust. Multiply yourself like the swarming locust. In other words, you need more soldiers. Come on, multiply yourself. How ironic is that? Multiply yourself. Here you are already in battle. You're already losing your soldiers in the battle. And God says, multiply yourself. You need more. It's sarcasm. It's like heaping sarcasm on the defeated enemy already. You see what God's doing? This is humiliation. This is like humiliation. Verse 16. And you have increased your traitors more than the stars of heaven. So this is a positive statement that just says they had great trade. Then the next part of the verse is bad because it says the creeping locust strips and flies away. And it's referring to the soldiers coming in and stripping off all the wealth. Verse 17 is a bad statement. It says your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts and your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers. Now, guardsmen are the people who are supposed to guard. Marshals are supposed to keep law and order. How are they described? They're described like locusts and grasshoppers that jump away and fly away. In other words, the idea is that all your protection is leaving. Everybody's going. Everybody's fleeing. And they're running to the stone walls. And what grasshoppers and locusts tend to do in a cold day is that they'll go to something that's warm. And so the picture here is that the stone walls are warm, so they're going to something warm, because otherwise, if they're cold, their wings get cold and they don't function very well. And so then they wait for the sun to rise and flee, and we're told that where they are is not known. Verse 18, 19 now is the end of the battle. Verse 18 is defeat. And 19 says there's no help. Verse 18 says, your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Now this time, the king of Assyria is addressed directly. And your nobles are lying down. Your people are scattered on the mountains. And there is no one to regather them. What's the picture? Total defeat. Bad news. Verse 19 says, and there's no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. In other words, there's no help. And all who hear about you will clap their hands over you. What's that? People are cheering. People are glad that Nineveh was defeated. For on whom has your evil passed continually? In other words, the people, they detest Nineveh so much, that they are just thrilled to see the city defeated. Go to Proverbs 29, verse 1. I want to wrap up the study with a couple of verses here. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 1. A man who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken beyond remedy. When the righteous increase, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, people, what? Grown. That's what's being described. Nineveh is defeated, and what are the people doing? They're rejoicing. They're glad. The righteous rejoice. The people rejoice at the destruction of Nineveh. We started the study by asking a question. Why? Why does Nahum have three chapters of a description of a battle that is really ugly, as you saw tonight? We went kind of quick. We didn't want to belabor it a lot because it's just nothing but gore, essentially all that's described here. But why? Why did God put that in the Bible? Let me give you three thoughts, okay? Go back to Nahum chapter 1. I'll give you three thoughts. This is our application. This is what to take away tonight. I don't think any of us want to go home and dream or think about how Nineveh got destroyed. I'm not sure that that's edifying per se, but chapter 1 maybe should be edifying. Remember what we saw when we were in chapter 1? We saw the attributes of God. Verse 2 said he's a jealous God. He's an avenging God. He's a wrathful God. Verse 3 said that God is slow to anger, has great power, and he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. That means he's just. The point that we made when we were in this passage, that God protects his people, and he's protecting his people. He's protecting his people. He is judging Nineveh that actually had judged the northern kingdom of Israel. And so God's jealous over his people, and God avenges sin. Then we kept reading all the way down all about God's power. We got to verse 7 and it says, the Lord is good. You know what the message of the book is? God's good. You might say, well, how can God be good? And you got three chapters of a description of battle. And it just keeps going. One's about a battle, two's about the same battle, three's about the same battle. I mean, like, how is this good? Message is, Nineveh was an evil city of an evil empire, and God decided to judge the evil empire because it got so bad. It became so evil that God judged it. Now that's a good God. Good God who judges evil. That's why I think there are three chapters that describe the battle. Let me give you a second thought. The second thought is that it reveals how much God hates evil and the great consequences there are to sin. Why don't you go to Revelation chapter 19, verse 20. You don't need to stay in Nahum. We're done. Go to Revelation 19, verse 20. This is the end of Armageddon. Christ has come on a horse. Verse 20 says, "And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast. And those who worshipped his image, these were thrown alive into the lake of fire." Now, this is a description of the lake of fire. I want you to see the description of the lake of fire. It says, which burns with what? Brimstone. So what's in the lake of fire? Brimstone. What's that? It's like coals. Hot coals. And the idea is that it's burning, all right? Now look at chapter 20, verse 10. You're going to see another description of the lake of fire. It says, "Then the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be having a great party day after day after day, night and day, forever and ever," right? That's not what it says. What does it say? "And they will be tormented day and night, forever and ever." Now, I got a question. Would you like to be in the lake of fire forever and ever and ever if you're being tormented and it has burning coals there, brimstone? If you go to the end of the chapter, verse 13 says, "And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one of them according to their deeds. And then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire." This is the second death, the lake of fire. "And if anyone's name was not written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire." I wouldn't want to be in the lake of fire. And what these verses tell us about the lake of fire is that it's forever, it's hot, it's burning, and it's torment. And it goes on and on and on forever. Watch this. What happened to the city of Nineveh in Nahum is nothing compared to what's going to happen in the lake of fire. It's nothing. And yet, when you read Nahum, we react to it. Three chapters of description of people dying, children being slaughtered, people being sold as slaves. I mean, it's unbelievable what Nahum describes. You say, like, why does God allow it to happen? Simple point. God hates sin a lot more than you and I do. We don't have a good picture of what sin is really like. We wink at it. Oh, I sinned. Oh, it's okay. But no, it's not okay. I think it caused God a lot of grief. If it wasn't for the blood of Jesus Christ covering us, he would see a very sinful person who deserves the lake of fire, right? We can be thankful that Christ died in our place. Let me give you the last reason. Turn to Matthew 5, 4, and we're done. Third reason, I think, why there's three chapters here. Description of a battle. Description of the destruction of Nineveh. Matthew 5, 4 says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." At first, this might seem like a funny verse to read or to apply tonight. The word for mourn just means to mourn, sadness, have grief. It's a present participle, which means that blessed are those, now watch this, blessed are those who are mourning and mourning and mourning and mourning. Did you know that it's blessed if you're mourning and mourning and mourning? Blessed are those who are mourning and mourning. Actually, the word blessed is makarios in the Greek, and it means happy. Happy are those who are mourning. How inconsistent does that seem to us? Because the happy person is a person who is actually mourning and mourning and mourning. You know what this is? You know what the Beatitudes describe? Beatitudes describe the person who's going to end up in heaven. You know who ends up in heaven? If you were to look at the first verse, verse 3, you'd find out that the person has a low view of their spiritual condition. They're beggars. They're asking God for anything. This is a humble person. What's being described is a Christian, the marks of a Christian who is humble. And verse 4 describes the marks of a Christian who is dealing with his sin. He mourns his sin. She mourns her sin. Nineveh, watch this, didn't mourn sin, and God hated it. Nineveh is a description of God's hatred for sin. That's what it's all about. And how should a Christian respond? Hate his sin too. Hate her sin too. And you don't do it just once. It's present participle. It just keeps going and going and going and going. You're always dealing with your sin. And you know what happens if you keep a clean record with God and you keep confessing your sin, you keep hating your sin, you keep dealing with your sin? It's going to result in happiness. But now if you start getting morbid and you don't forgive yourself and you get caught up in it, then that's another problem. That's actually a sin too. But if you're dealing with sin, you're dealing with sin effectively, actually it turns out to be happiness. That's the message of Matthew chapter 5, verse 4. That's what Jesus said. Let's pray.